Now, you're very welcome back to the program. Now, it's time for this.
The Executive Chair.
Now, take a listen to this. Yes, we're going all cultural on you on Down to Business in the Executive Chair today. Delighted to welcome my guest. He's Simon Taylor. He's the Chief Executive of the National Concert Hall. Simon, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, Simon, I suppose culture, something that we're all interested in. I'm not saying we're very cultural on this programme, but we're interested in you. We're interested in your career path. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Were you from a musical family?
I'm not from a musical family, no. It sort of came out of the blue. I started out as a classical guitar player, although I did find an old portrait of a great-great-great-grandmother with a guitar somewhere in the 19th century. So it was somewhere in the bloodstream, I suppose, somewhere in the genes. But I fell in love with playing the guitar as a kid and then studied that and then later on went from that into the sort of management side of music.
Okay, so music was your first love. It probably still is your first love.
It would still be, yes, absolutely.
I know you're just trying to put an age on you, but when you were growing up as a young teenager, would it not more have been about Jimi Hendrix, the Beatles? What brought you down the classical route?
Absolutely. My sister was a fanatical Beatles fan. Yeah, I'd pictures plastered all over a bedroom. So yes, I was of that generation growing up with the Beatles. Yeah, I suppose like a lot of kids, it's down to your teachers. I had a teacher at school who was an eminent organist and fanatical classical musician, as it were. Bach was his god. So I suppose it was through that I became interested in the classical side of music rather than the popular at the time.
And what was your first job then around in music?
My first job, I mean, I did what a lot of musicians do, went off and studied. At that stage, you think you're going to be the next Segovia or the next Julian Bream or something. And you rapidly find out afterwards that there are several thousand others.
And you need to pay the bills.
And you need to pay the bills. So when I came back, I studied in London. When I came back to Ireland, I did, again, what a lot of musicians do. I did a bit of playing, a bit of teaching. You make your few bob where you can. And through that, I had the opportunity of running New Park Music Centre when it first started in the early 1980s. So that was sort of my first taste of the administration side of music, and I suppose found that I had a flair for it and an appetite for it, and went on from there.
And were you involved in the RTE Orchestra at any stage?
Indeed, yes. I went into RTE in 1990, initially to run the concert orchestra, and then was later head of orchestras and performing groups in RTE. So that was the National Symphony Orchestra, the concert orchestra, and the quartet and choirs. So
tell me a bit about that as an organisation. I look at it in two ways. Obviously, it's steeped in culture and it's great for what it does. I'd suggest that if you're a professional musician, it's a manner from heaven in that you can get a paid gig and maybe do other gigs as well, and it can pay the bills. There has been a lot of criticism around it, Simon, around the cost of keeping these orchestras going relative to the licence fee and all that. Where are you on what's your stance
Absolutely.
On all that?
Absolutely. Well, historically, of course, radio stations having orchestras goes way back to the founding of broadcasting. And in fairness to RTE, you'd have to say that had RTE not done it for the last 70, 80 years, who else would have? So, you know, the National Symphony Orchestra, for instance, does fulfill the role that its name suggests. It is our National Symphony Orchestra. And in any country, that would be funded through the state in some way or other. I suppose it's funded slightly at second hand through the license fee, but nonetheless, it is public money. So it doesn't differ in that way from a lot of other models.
And these are expensive machines to run.
They can't be otherwise. I mean, the main cost of an orchestra is that you've got to have 70 or 80 people on stage, and they've got to be paid, and they've got to be paid not just for the concert, which you see, but for all the rehearsal that goes into it. You know, what you see on the day is only a little part of the work that's gone into it.
Okay, well, you're clearly on the positive side of maintaining the National Philharmonic Orchestra, and you see the benefits of same. You worked in Northern Ireland, you also worked in Bournemouth. Tell me about those. Yeah.
Well, in Northern Ireland, I worked for another great broadcaster, the BBC.
Yeah.
I was in charge of the classical music output for BBC Northern Ireland, which was sort of a mix of work for Radio Ulster, for the local network, and also for Radio 3 in London. Great job, because it was working with the Ulster Orchestra locally. It was doing music documentaries, etc. And again, that gives you a real insight into what most people would, I think, agree is the from a quality point of view, the finest broadcaster in the world. And they are the biggest supporter of classical music of any broadcast organisation in the
world. Right. Yeah, okay.
And the biggest commissioner of new music in the world.
Now, my guest is Simon Taylor. He's chief executive of the National Concert Hall. We're in the executive chair. We're talking classical music. We're not talking Iron Maiden. We're not talking Cradle of Filth. We're talking absolute classic stuff. Yeah. And he's a classically trained guitarist as well. Let's go to the National Concert Hall, Simon, and tell us a little bit about that organisation.
Yeah, well, interestingly, although you refer to classical music, the concert hall is actually about a good deal more than classical music. Obviously,
right.
it is regarded as the home of classical music in Ireland, and we are the base for the National Symphony Orchestra and the Concert Orchestra as well. But we cover a huge amount of musical genres. I mean, the biggest selling ticket at the moment is a series of concerts with the Gloaming next spring. You know, we have, you know, 70s pop icons like Lulu and Albert Hammond coming up.
Gave it up for music in a free electric band, no less.
You know, so there is a huge amount. We obviously have, you know, we promote a program ourselves, which we have our international concert season, which is visiting orchestras and sort of very eminent classical musicians. But also we rely strongly on a range of commercial external promoters who hire the hall and bring things to us, you know.
So as I understand it, the way you're funded currently is you're one third funded by the state and two thirds of your own activities that you generate. And you alluded to some of them there, where effectively you hire out, you take a percentage of the turnover,
exactly.
etc. So there's all sorts of different models.
It's an interesting model as a cultural institution because we are a state-funded national cultural institution. But unlike, say, the National Gallery or the museum, we charge admission fees and we have to support ourselves very largely through our own activities.
And what are the responsibilities of that one-third state funding? Like, so if you're state-funded, how does that restrict you? Or does it?
It's not so much it restricts, it gives you a certain remit to do certain things. So there'd be a lot of things that we do that aren't commercially viable in their own right. I mean, as we've already touched on, you could not run a symphony orchestra without subsidy from somewhere. Likewise, we couldn't bring in major visiting orchestras or world-class artists without a degree of subsidy, particularly in a hall that's only 1,200 seats. There's a very definite limit to how much box office revenue you can generate for any event. So, you know, we would support those sort of events. We run an education program. We support young musicians. And I suppose generally we would see ourselves as supporting the musical infrastructure of the country.
But you don't really see yourself as a place that has 1,200 seats that has to fill them every night of the week. That isn't, you're looking at it more like, because otherwise would you not be in a whole lot of other genres than you already are?
Well, we do see that selling the 1,200 seats is a vitally important part of what we do. It doesn't mean you have to sell the 1,200 every single time. For instance, you support, say, the Veronica Dunn singing competition and you do the semi-finals. You know you're not going to be selling out the hall, but equally you know that you're supporting something that's really important for the musical life of the country. But you balance that then by doing things where you know full well that you will sell your 1,200 seats. So it's a constant juggle, really, balancing that. And you referred to RTE earlier on. RTE has that same dilemma of balancing a public service remit with a commercial operation. And it's always a tricky thing to do.
And 1,200 seats, is that the optimum, or would you like to see double that, or what's the ideal size for what you do?
That's a very interesting question. There was a plan before the demise of the Celtic Tiger to put in a bigger hall, a bigger symphony hall, which would have been over 2,000 seats. I think probably in retrospect that was a little overambitious. It always depends on the size of the city in which you work. I would think ideally if you were starting from a blank slate, you'd probably make it a little bit bigger, maybe 1,500. But having said that, you know, for a lot of the stuff we do, 1,200 is exactly right. And it has the advantage as well that from an international point of view, it feels like quite an intimate hall. So you have a lot of big artists that come here playing the National Concert Hall and actually love the fact that it does feel to them quite an intimate space.
Okay, now next year is 2016, all sorts of commemorations going on. You've got your own relationship there with Kevin Barry, the site of the great treaty debate. So do you intend to capitalise on that?
We do. I mean, obviously, the site we're on was at the time of the treaty, the National University, or I suppose it would have been the Royal University still at that point. And the treaty debates in 1921, after the signing of the treaty in London, took place in the National Concert Hall, or what is the National Concert Hall now, in the rooms above the portico when you come in. They were subsequently renamed the Kevin Barry Rooms by UCD, Kevin Barry having been a medical student in the university. And then when the university moved out and we took over those spaces, we kept that name.
Right.
And as part of the 2016 commemorations, we've got funding to now repurpose those rooms as a 120-seat recital space, which for us will be a huge advantage to our programme because, as we touched on a minute ago, we have a 1,200-seat auditorium. We also have what's called the John Field Room, which is effectively the inner foyer of the hall, which we can only use then obviously when we're not using the main auditorium.
Yeah.
So for the first time, we'll now have a programmable small space, which will allow us to do more classical chamber music, more traditional music, more sort of small-scale jazz and things like that, more contemporary music,
okay,
which will be a great addition.
Well, listen, we'd like to thank you for coming in. It sounds like a fantastic organisation. It's very steeped in culture and all that good stuff.
Indeed.
And I have to say, I've been educated here talking to you this morning. So thanks very much for popping in and thanks very much for every success with the National Concert Hall. That's Simon Taylor there. He's our executive chair guest this week. Thanks very much.
Thank you.